If Venezuela proved easier than Iran, where Donald Trump is still looking for a win as we speak, could that explain why the attention seems to be turning to Cuba? The United States last week dispatching its CIA director to Havana and offering aid while its crippling blockade plunges the communist island nation in the dark. We'll ask about carrots and sticks in the latest in a long, very long list of pressure campaigns. History's littered with failed U.S. attempts at regime change in Cuba, dating all the way back to 1959, the revolution led by Fidel Castro, by the way, would have turned 100 this year. We'll ask our panel if this time is any different for a regime that's survived embargoes and the end of the Cold War, the decline of agriculture and sugarcane exports, successive waves of mass emigration. It's the son of Cuban immigrants, Marco Rubio, who's been front and center in this standoff. Just how much does the U.S. Secretary of State's push jibe with what citizens of Cuba want or need in 2026? Today in the France 24 debate, will Trump set his sights on Cuba instead of Iran? Joining us from Gainesville, Florida, Lillian Guerra, director of the Cuba program at the University of Florida. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. And also, it's guerra, which actually means war, although I'm in favor of peace.
Okay.
So you know.
Guerra. Thanks for the correction there. France 24 journalist Luis Miguel Cabrera is with us as well. How are you?
Very concerned, of course, about the situation in
We'll get
Cuba
to that
nowadays.
In a moment.
Yeah.
Charlotte Balavoine heads the French Communist Party's solidarity campaign with Cuba. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for receiving us.
And Axel Gilden, journalist at the French news weekly magazine L'Express. You were the co-author of The Double Life of Fidel Castro, My 17 Years as Personal Bodyguard to El Leader Maximo, co-written with the man who was that bodyguard. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You can, by the way, always listen. That's right. Listen to the France 24 debate, wherever podcasts are streamed. Let's begin with the latest. For the fifth time since February, a Mexican cargo ship loaded with humanitarian aid docking this Monday in Cuba. What's not aboard the Panamanian-flagged Asian Catra is fuel, desperately needed fuel. The country's run out. Shirley Sitbon has more.
Cubans have long had to live with little, but daily life has turned into a struggle for survival since the U.S. tightened its blockade on the island. Since the last oil lifeline from Venezuela was cut in January, there has been limited fuel, and now Cuba is out of oil reserves. This week, a massive blackout hit 7 out of 15 provinces before power was gradually restored.
Have you walked around Havana at night? It's all dark. There's nowhere to go. And the prices, we'd never seen anything like this.
Having close to no fuel doesn't just mean cars can't move. It puts lives at risk in hospitals and across the country.
Disruption to electricity and fuel supplies are affecting safe water, food production, disruption to the cold chain, which all require fuel to function.
Cubans are dreading worse days ahead, including a U.S. invasion, after several threats made by President Donald Trump as recently as Friday.
So, I mean, look, I've been hearing about Cuba since I'm a little boy. They've been saying, what's going on with Cuba? And I think we'll be turning it. I think they're going to have to come to us. It's a failed nation. It's a totally failed nation.
Cuban local authorities have issued a guide on what to do in case of a U.S. invasion, including how to keep water, food, and medicine. While some criticize authorities for failing to lower tensions, others believe there is no easy way of dealing with a U.S. blockade. Meanwhile, talks continue between representatives from both countries.
Luis Miguel Cabrera, I see you brought that manual.
Yeah.
What is that again? Explain to us.
So this is a guide that the Cuban government has provided every family in the country. And it contains explanations of why the situation is so dire and dangerous at the moment. Not only the most recent blockade, but, you know, the rhetoric of the Trump administration. And it's interesting that it's mainly preparing people for airstrikes. In the island. So mainly explaining what to do in case of a siren goes on. You need to know where to go. You need to get your bag prepared with the water, medicine, and things you're gonna need to survive. Either
of course
on the ground, or in a tunnel, or in any other place you can find to hide, basically.
Of course, right now, the number one concern is the fact that there's no fuel.
Yes. Yeah. And with all the humanitarian consequences that triggers, mainly for, let's say, hospitals, for example, there are thousands of people who are waiting for surgery. They can't go and get a surgery unless there's an emergency or there's an accident or something like that. Same thing for schools and same thing for water. If you don't have fuel, you cannot pump water. You can think of a mother who has to wake up every day at 1 a.m. because between 1 and 3, that's when she's going to get 2 hours of daily electricity. And she knows that she won't get the power back in at least 22 or 24 hours. If the electrical grid doesn't collapse, which happens very often, that person will have to wake up that time, prepare food for their kids, bring their kids to school. If school is functioning, they have to go to work. If she's a doctor or a nurse, for example, she has to go to the hospital and face patients knowing what they have and telling them, sorry, I don't have the medicine that you need at the moment, even though it's something that is not complicated to get. Everything scarce in Cuba at the moment. And that same mother will have to go home at 7 p.m. without any electricity, without running water, and start over again. And that's a reality for many families in Cuba for years now, because all this started after the COVID pandemic, economic crisis, tourism not going back to pre-pandemic levels, the government losing a lot of good opportunities to implement measures to boost the economy or try to take any measure so that people can breathe a little bit and provide them with more freedom to do business or, produce in the island. So when you take into account all these factors, it's a humanitarian catastrophe, and people they don't have any hope at the moment. It's very dire and sad.
Lillian Guerra, as you heard there from Luis Miguel, there's plenty of blame to go around, but how are people processing this this current crisis right now where you are?
Well, I would say that one of the most important factors here is that the CIA showed up last week in person. And really, that is extraordinary, in part because the Cubans had never seen on their island representatives with a face and a name. The CIA seems to be adopting a strategy of transparency rather than secrecy. And in doing so, is pointing to the fact that the Cuban government relies on secrecy, relies on censorship. Most Cubans had no electricity, so they had no idea of what was happening, when it was happening. I think that the main message of the CIA is that they want to send this to the Cuban government and to the Cuban people. It's don't play with fire. Like, the last thing standing between you guys and Donald Trump and the White House is us. I think the CIA also wanted to send a message to the Cuban people as to who is really in charge. I think the foreign press has also been erroneous in sort of representing the civilian government, the Communist Party, as really being in charge. I mean, in reality, they're not. And the Ministry of the Interior, the armed forces control the security state, but they also control the economy. And they make the decisions. So the people who are behind the table, secretly behind the table, who we were hearing about, including the grandson, including the grandnephew of Raul and Fidel. These are men that were really unknown to most Cubans.
Yeah, I want to get back to that in a moment.
Yeah.
Before we go into that, the stunning visit, as you describe it, of CIA Director John Radcliffe, I just want to ask just briefly at the outset here, Charlotte Bedavoine, because you were, last month? In Cuba, tell us what you saw when you were there.
Well, actually, what I saw, it's a little bit what you were saying before, is that the population is in traumatic situation right now. And this is true that we have all society, which is to point to collapse. But why is it collapsing right now? Is it collapsing because of the policy of the United States? And because what's going on now, it's not only a lack of international law and the destruction of the international law, what's going on with Cuba and the policy of the United States, but is as well a state of war. And the thing is that this didn't begin in the last months. In reality, the embargo, the blockade, began in the 1962. But now, since the 3rd of January, no fuel can go to Cuba except the boat from Russia who went to the to Laban. So the question that we have to ask, and this is why I fully disagree with the person who speak before me, is that for me, the impression I had is that the fact that the first representative of the US who is going to Cuba is the director of CIA, for me, it's a really, really bad signal. This is a signal that what CIA did to Venezuela a time ago or to the other country in Latin America. This means that the diplomacy of the United States, they don't want to have dialogue with Cuba. They just want to put pressure and threaten and continue to threaten Cuba. And the question is why? And I think that I fully agree on the fact that the people right now, they cannot anymore. I mean, it's a really complicated situation when you wake up in the morning and you don't know how you will pass the day and that you know that the day after will be worse than the day before. But at one point, I mean, what's going on with Cuba? Can we imagine for a second that this would go going on in France, for instance, in Paris, if for 1 week, just 1 week, we wouldn't have any electricity in Paris? And this is what's going on in Cuba. And I think this will be a total mess, which is not at the moment.
Exegilden, why did Donald Trump dispatch the CIA director to be the one to visit?
Yeah. I will answer to that in a minute, but I just want to add to what you just say that it means this is a narrative we have heard in the last six decades, and the real reason for the collapse of the Cuban economy is the exact same reason that for the collapse of the Romanian economy, the whole Eastern Bloc in Europe, or the Soviet Union. There was no, everything was nationalized for years, there was no incentive to create wealth, and that's the main reason. Of course, the embargo didn't help, although 50% of the meat is coming from the U.S. and all the meat and medicines. But so the embargo is just a tiny part of Cuba's problem. Then why did Trump dispatch, that's very interesting, the CIA director? Because Cuba is a police state. And now it's obvious. That's the beauty of it. So if you want to discuss the real business, I mean, not PR, but with the real people in charge, which with the Dirección de Inteligencia, the Secret Service, with the army, with the generals who owns 100% of the economy, or at least 50%. I mean, it depends how you count. But Gaesa owns 40% of the whole economy, and they do that not for the good for the.
This is the conglomerate that runs the economy.
Sorry?
Gaesa, the
Gaesa is a consortium that runs the economy. So, I mean, it's the negotiation at the end of the day will happen between CIA and the police state, and the police state is have generals and have the equivalent of the CIA, and those are the people you have to talk with.
Now, on this point, Lilian Guerra, I interrupted you earlier, so let's go back to that point. On the other side of the table, across from Radcliffe, reportedly the grandson of Raul Castro, Raul Guillermo Rodriguez Castro. Critics refer to him as the crab, the 40-year-old who's also been serving as his grandfather's bodyguard. What do you make of that?
Well, he has already been in the news quite a bit, and I actually think that he was less important in this meeting than a man named General Ramon Romero Curbelo, who is the director of intelligence and is really the counterpart to the director of the CIA. The reason that the three of them being there, so in addition to Raul Guillermo Rodriguez Castro, you also had Oscar Perez Lopez Fraga, you had other members of the sort of the contingent of people who have been negotiating on the other side of Washington's table. The reason to put all of them there is precisely what my colleague just said, is that you have a real shadow government that is the government and that has been in control not just of the economy, but in control of people's lives through that economy. And I want to correct something. Gaesa is not really a government-controlled entity. It was created by Raul Castro as a company in 2009. It's run by the Ministry of the Armed Forces. But the Cuban ombudsman, the person in charge of the budget and accounting for the Cuban state, has actually no access to how they spend the profits from Gaesa. Gaesa is an entity which is run by really the joint, they're really the counterpart to joint ventures, foreign investment in Cuba. And who are they? They are the generals, they are the top officials of the armed forces with some overlap in the Ministry of the Interior, and they're millionaires. They have at least $18 billion that we know of in foreign accounts. That money is not money that's being used to buy rice, to buy oil, to make sure that the schools are running. None of that has been used for years. I mean, it is very much the case that this is a government of the right in so many respects, except in name. And it's a traditional military dictatorship based on crony capitalism. So putting that all on display was, I think, a brilliant strategy on the part of the CIA. Because we're finally getting to the nucleus of the point. The Cuban people really are blaming the Cuban government, and in particular, Gaesa and this model of self-enrichment of a 1% to 3% of the population, many of whom have the last name Castro or somehow related to the cronies that have been running the place for decades. So that this is what really matters. I think right. We're at a breaking point, though, because we're at war in so many respects. And you know, the person who spoke from the Communist Party perspective of France, yes, undoubtedly. And I think that it's a tipping point. And that's what matters, that it's a tipping point.
Luis Miguel Cabrera.
Yeah, no, I was just talking to several sources I have in Cuba about this El Cangrejo presence in those negotiations. And people are... It's actually hard to understand why the U.S. administration decided to go and talk to him, because he's hated in Miami. He's part of the Castro family, and in Cuba he is completely unknown. His presence there, his presence there in the table of negotiations is not justified by talent, by performance, by any official nomination. He's just the guy who is very close to the guy who actually calls the shots in Cuba, which is Raúl Castro, his grandson. And I wouldn't just to respond to Lilia, I wouldn't be absolute on saying that 100% of the Cuban people blame the government for what's happening at the moment. I think the discontent with the government performance is increasing. I would say that most of the people think that, but not everyone.
All right, interviewed over the weekend by Fox News. The U.S. Secretary of State, again, the son of Cuban immigrants, commented on that $100 million offer of U.S. aid that's been put on the table by the Trump administration.
Forget about it doesn't go to the people. It doesn't even go to the government. The wealth is controlled by a private, by a company owned by military generals. They take all the money. They're sitting on billions of dollars. Okay, this is a country where people are literally now eating garbage from the streets. But they have a company that controls all of the money making there that's sitting on $15, $16 billion. So it's a broken, non-functional economy, and it's impossible to change it. I wish it were different, but I believe, it's my personal opinion, you cannot change the economic trajectory of Cuba as long as the people who are in charge of it now are in charge of it. That's what's gonna have to change, because these people are proven incapable. I hope I'm wrong. We'll give them a chance, but I don't think it's gonna happen.
Charlotte Belafonte, will give them a chance. Your reaction to that?
Yeah, actually, this is a shame to say like this. I mean, the only question we have today is that is Cuba a choice for United States or not? This is the whole argument of the Donald Trump administration. Of course, no one can say concretely and seriously that Cuba is a choice. Now, is it Cuba collapsing because of the system, or is Cuba collapsing because of the blockade? I would say... okay, maybe let's give a chance to the system and we will see how they can do without any blockade. And then we can judge. We can judge. But saying now, okay, we are doing this. We will give you some money because we will do charity with you after trying to strangle you. I mean, this is really a shame. And I would say that, come on, at one moment, I think the only question is this. You were saying before, this is a police state, this is why we sent the director of the CIA. But okay, when Obama went to Cuba, and Obama went to Cuba, they sent the president of the United States. They had agreements. They managed somehow to load on the blockade at that moment. So this means that you can have political speech as well from one administration to another. The reality is that since months now, Marco Rubio is saying that he's dialoguing with Cuban authority. This is false. He's only dialoguing with a person who doesn't have any mandate.
Charlotte, let me ask you this, because we saw with Venezuela, we thought that when there was that raid at the beginning of the year, that the United States would try to remove the government, but they didn't. They just removed the head. Do you see the Trump administration doing business with the current regime in Havana?
Why not? I mean, the question is that why the government doesn't want to...
So they could be the same model in Cuba.
No, actually, the thing is, yes, this can be... You're giving a really interesting question. And because the question is that, will the United States do an invasion to Cuba as it did in Venezuela? Will they try to wrap the president of Cuba as it did in Venezuela? And this is really one of the big dangers that we have right now. You were just showing something. I didn't see this document before, but you were just showing this at the beginning of the EC mission. And this is the real threat now. I mean, for the Cuban people, I think this is the real threat. And I would say, okay, why such... I mean, such a focus on Cuba for so many decades for United States. And I think this focus is only ideological. They cannot stand the fact that an island decided to be independent. And this is not because of communism or everything. This is because an island decided to be independent at 100 miles of the coast of Florida. And I think this is why now they are doing this, and because Trump wants a victory before the midterm, as is now in a danger in Iran.
So it's interesting they're saying that they would love to do business with the Raul family, because at the end of the day, it's a family-owned business, and they have a very great business model. You know what it is? The business model in the U.S. is you go on holiday in Cuba, you go on holiday, you pay $150 to a room, and all the people who are serving you are paid $11 a month. That's the great libertarian, pro-Trump. Yes, it is true.
No.
Then you said not 100% are against the government. That's true. Actually, El Toque, who did an inquiry based on 42,000 phone calls, 60% of them in the island, 40% outside the island, came to the conclusion that 94% of the Cubans disapprove the system because they know it's a failed system. When Barack Obama came, he tried. There was this thaw with Raul Castro, and actually, it benefited the Raul Castro.
This was 2016.
Raul Castro's business, but it's important to underline that Fidel Castro himself and all the old guard weren't really happy with that rapprochement between Raul and Obama. So the reason why it failed wasn't the election of Donald Trump, because it failed before Donald Trump was elected. It was starting to fail. And finally, what's the reason for the United States to be unhappy with Cuba? Well, first of all, they expropriated Cuban business. Then there was the crisis of the missiles, where a very nice country called USSR put its missile pointed at the United States.
But that's a long time ago, 1962.
Yeah, but still, a long time ago. So you can't believe they have 300 drones, no problem. That's easy. That's an easy one. Finally, Fidel Castro, who we must say, let me just finish on that.
Go ahead.
Who was a political genius, and you cannot say anything else. He was extremely smart, probably the most intelligent leader in Latin America, if not in the world during his time, but he managed to create a hostile axis of power, helping Chavez to stay in power, to create another dictatorship, and the Nicaraguan to come back in power. And then also with the very brilliant and competent Cuban Secret Service, infiltrate not only Latin American governments and make this influential diplomacy, but also United States diplomacy, with the moles and the spies. The recent one was Manuel Rocha, of course, but there have been several of them. So you bet United States thinks, I mean, there is a hostile power, you know, by the way, allied with Russia, with China, with Iran, who has also training camps, who had for PLO, for Hezbollah, for IRA, and et cetera. So it's not exactly a country that is very, very nice neighbor, I think, from the point of view of the United States.
All right, with Florida, again, as you say, 90 miles away, the former head of the CIA, in a television interview with CBS over the weekend, warning that the biggest threat to the United States right now, well, it's actually a repeat of what was seen in 1980 with the Mariel Boat People crisis, when thousands took to small boats.
The biggest risk is that we end up with another Mariel evacuation from Cuba that has tens of thousands of Cubans heading to the United States out of desperation, as happened a number of years ago. So I think that's actually, at this point, the biggest threat. You know, the Cubans have had a lot of security people in Venezuela. They formed the security cordon around Maduro. He didn't trust his own people. They've done this in other countries. So they have been involved in ways that impact our national security and our interests in their engagement in other countries for a long time. Mm-hmm. Are they an imminent threat to the United States? Other than in these, if you will, peripheral ways, I think the main threat is, frankly, is collapse.
Lillian Guerra, do you share Robert Gates's view that the biggest problem would be a collapse, an entire collapse of the Cuban state?
I've been saying that. Yes, I've been saying that for months. I think one of the few things that has been holding back the Trump administration, which is being pressed by its right flank, especially among Cuban exiles in Miami who are members of Congress and who are his advisors, including Marco Rubio, is the reality that chaos could ensue. And you don't just have the chaos of having potentially hundreds of thousands of people taking to the waters. You have the chaos in Cuba, because a lot of people are very, very angry at, though they're not their neighbors, not all of their neighbors, but certainly the Committees for the Defense of the Revolution, the Communist Party itself, people know who have been in charge of informing on them, who have prevented their kid from getting into college because they weren't sufficiently loyal to the regime. I mean, this is decades of having had a system that politically discriminates against people. And it's not a meritocracy. It is never intended to be, at least not since the adoption of communism. That's an open fact. We don't have to revisit either, I think, the reality that Cuba and the United States have been enemies since Fidel Castro adopted communism. That, for Cubans, is like discovering warm water, descubrir el agua tibia, as Cubans would say on the island. What is important is that since 1991 to 93, we have a state capitalist economy in Cuba that has somehow managed to survive mostly by managing the ability of the citizenry to access what is a capitalist regime. And the partners in that have been foreign investors who are not minor players in this. They are huge names. And we know them, especially in Europe, right? So you have foreign investors and the Cuban communist state, largely Ministry of the Armed Forces since Raul took power, so it's not even the civilians. And you don't really have internal competition anymore in this model between certain state capitalist companies and others and an entrepreneurial class. You really don't. But
let me ask you, Lillian, I just want to go back to that clip of the former CIA director and defense secretary, Robert Gates, because he's saying when it comes to the national security threat to the United States, Cuba ranks more as an annoyance than an actual existential threat for the U.S. So on that score, why is Washington doing it?
Well, I think in large part we're ignoring the incredible power that the Republican Party wield simply by controlling the vote in the state of Florida. We have also had an exodus of 2 million Cubans in the last 3 years. 800,000 of them is estimated are in Florida. And that's in addition to the already existing population, which is economically and politically empowered and extremely politicized. So you have multiple generations of Cubans who are calling openly for military intervention. Now, I don't happen to be one of them. But if I were in Miami and I'm willing to say that anywhere, as I am, you know, I would be shouted down, because you have a degree of anger. You have people who have a stake in revenge upon the government that took stuff from them. Some of them deserved it because they stole in order to acquire their plantations and their wealth, but others didn't. And then there are generations of Cubans who were never wealthy and yet had to resist under this regime. And among them are very new people, young people who have left. And people are desperate. And I think that the degree of desperation is that we no longer have a normal degree of desperation on the island. We have a situation which kids can't go to school. Nothing is functioning. You have maybe 2 hours of electricity at most per day. We have some days that have gone entirely with nothing, 32 hours, 46 hours. And you have this kind of complete national strike in terms of the inability of people to even participate in an economy because it doesn't exist. Today, Reuters has reported that 60% of the shipping that comes to Cuba is from Europe, and that the European shippers canceled their contracts with the Cuban government. So we're at a tipping point, and I think that it is really necessary that the Cuban government not decide to deploy some drones to the Guantanamo base or to Key West, or to somehow make some kind of ideological statement for which it really has no leg to stand anymore, economically, politically, or socially, and effectively negotiate the terms of a transition to some form of democracy that would include a civilian-led, civil society-led council of state that would displace these folks. And the millionaires, including those who negotiated or sat with the CIA director, they need to be stripped of this money that they have, the $18 billion that are somehow in these offshore accounts. That money belongs to the Cuban people. It was made by Gaesa, which should be subject to the same kinds of rules that any constitutional state would oversee over these accounts. So that's what I'm seeing. And yeah.
All right. So I think it's sad what Lillian is saying, in the sense that you are using human suffering as a political tool.
Yes.
I mean, you cannot.
It's a war.
But you cannot force the government to do. I mean, it's an independent country. It has challenges, but there are other ways to do this. In this sense, I respected very much the steps Obama took in order to engage Cuba and try to pursue the same goals, but in a different manner, preventing human suffering. And everything.
I mean, I'm all over Obama. I agree. But Trump is not Obama. That's the scary part. That's really scary.
But we cannot justify that, I think.
But you have to put this in the geopolitical context as well. I mean, the national defense strategy and the national security strategy was published at the end of last year. And it's all about having China out of the back door of the United States, which is Panama, that goes for Venezuela. Eventually it will go for Cuba and for Nicaragua. And that's the game we're in. That's the big picture. Then the small picture, I always want to, when I participate like such a debate, always forgot to say, I just wonder why people support a country that currently has 1,260 political prisoners, amongst which 35 kids, among which two girls. I mean, this is like goes beyond my understanding.
Just to be clear, you just said two things in the same sentence.
Yeah, they're not connected.
Right, because on the one hand, you're talking about the political prisoners in Cuba. On the other, you're talking about
China?
The United States' policy position, which is this new Monroe Doctrine, the Western Hemisphere is ours.
Yeah. Describing it. I don't have
an
opinion on that.
Shallow
putting
that
it in
one.
Context.
Yeah, but I think you said it on one hand, and the other intervened as well, is that the goal of the American policy right now towards Cuba is to provoke desperation and anger. And this is not new. No. I mean, this was described in the policy of the United States against Cuba in 1960, even before the blockade. And this was the Mallory Decree. So this didn't change. And I think the intervenant from US pretty much said this. So this is to use the population, whatever you think about the Cuban regime or system, whatever you think about the government itself. I mean, this is not the question right now. The question is that, do we want international law, or do we want each state, and specifically United States, to threaten everyone? And for once, I would say, and this is maybe the first time and last time of my life I will say this, I pretty much agree with what was said by the previous director of the CIA, is that the collapsing of Cuba will be a twist as itself, and not only for United States. It will be a twist for the whole America, and it will be a twist for France as well. As you know, we have as well some territory of France nearby Cuba. This is Guadeloupe, Martinique, and Guyane. And actually, if tomorrow Cuba is collapsing, first of all, this Doctrine Monroe that you were just talking about, this will be the next step. I mean, why the U.S. will admit to have some French territory in their continent when the Doctrine Monroe is pretty much saying that we do not want Europe.
France is not a hostile power to the United States. So I mean, the parallel is ridiculous.
Let's be honest. There were treason. We have some twists right now on Groenland. tomorrow we can have some trees on
Greenland.
On Greenland, yeah. Yes. And the other thing is that we all know what will come up with Cuba if United States decide tomorrow to put some bombs or to kidnap Cuba and to put their own regime or Marco Rubio as president. I mean, it's happening with Haiti right now.
This means
a state which has no direction, which is totally covered of traffic, and where the population is in a humanitarian situation collapsing every time. And this is what we do not want. You can agree or not with the Cuban state, but what we are saying is just that the Cuban people should decide for the Cuban people. And this is the point. And we are asking France to react, because this is really a choice. I think, why not the government of the United States is a choice for the entire world. And if we want to have a world which is demanded by one only country, then we have to continue to shut up on what's going on.
I repeat, the plan is not to create starvation. The plan is not to kill Cubans. By the way, you're right. It's a problem for the United States. They try to do something a bit difficult.
Does Marco Rubio have a plan? Because I mean, that's the big criticism of the United States when it comes to Iran, that it doesn't really have a plan.
So the plan seems to be get rid of the communist dictatorship, which imprisons 1,260 political prisoners and has created economic ruin in the last 60 years, and that has harbored hostile powers like Iran, Hezbollah, you name it. So I think that is the plan, because, and it's written in the military doctrine.
Poor Lillian Gehr. We got to fly you in, Lillian, next time, because you're at a disadvantage by video link. Go ahead, please.
So I'll just be quick. I want to say that, you know, in the long term, perhaps Marco Rubio's plan or anybody's plan might be displacement of the state. But precisely because of what Gates said the last in this last interview, you know, that chaos and allowing the government to collapse, or simply releasing the Cuban Coast Guard from duty and flooding the waters. I mean, everybody wants, both the people in Washington as well as in Havana that are in charge, want to prevent that, because it would be devastating for both countries, for both of their political goals. But I do think that there is a softening that we're missing. So now we know there's $100 million on the table. We know that Marco Rubio went to see the Pope, who's an American and who is, I think, in favor of peace, as most popes have been in recent years, if not always. This is a sign that there is another path, and that there is a willing party, that the Cuban government itself, through Bruno Rodriguez, its Minister of Foreign Relations, has endorsed. That is the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church has a very strong presence on the island. It is discreet because it is also subject to tremendous pressure from the Cuban government. And yet it has people. It has a kind of legitimacy factor that would allow for some moment of transition to happen through the distribution of aid. And that would alleviate, just giving some more time to this process, would alleviate the warmongers from taking command of this situation and then bringing about what is really a you're with us or against us scenario. And I think that there are multiple factors that are preventing that from ultimately being the scenario, including the CIA's trip, including Marco Rubio revealing some of the details of this plan, and including the fact that the Cuban people are now thinking in terms not of their own government being the sole representative. And I don't think that they think the United States is at all. But I think that they are demanding to have a voice and a role. And the Cuban government does not equate to the will of the Cuban people, who have never elected them. And they have been in power for 67 years.
Right.
And they control every aspect of their lives.
So Luis Miguel Cabrera, we heard Marco Rubio say he wants the disbursement of this $100 million in aid to go through international organizations. And as was just said by Lillian, he specifically named the Catholic Church. Could the Catholic Church play a big role?
They have done it in the past, so yes. And not only with the U.S. donations, but donations from other countries. I just want to say that this is $100 million is just a band-aid. And, of course, everyone will welcome that. Even the Cuban people will welcome that aid. But it's a little bit contradictory and cynic, to be fair, that you
Cynical,
that you are blocking an island, just no oil and other sanctions for several years, and then you're sending $100 million of aid. you know, this is not going to solve the problem. And I just wanted to say something on these Axios report regarding the...
Yeah, Axios, the news site over the weekend, is saying that the Cubans were in possession of some 300 drones.
That they purchased from Russia and Iran. I think this, at least what they reported, can be read or used for both scenarios. If you want to use, if you want to pursue the dialogue as a scenario, the talk scenario, the negotiation scenario, the diplomacy, you can use a second part of that report in which they say the CIA has assessed the situation and they don't find any threat in Cuba. But if you want to actually go on with the military option, you can use the first part of it, which is actually they're buying drones from Russia. There are Russian and Iranian officials in Cuba, even though the purpose of all that cooperation is defensive. Because no one has been able to prove that they will attack the U.S. It would be ridiculous to attack the U.S. You know, to go first. They're gonna be reduced to dust.
And just Luis Miguel, you heard Charles, because we're almost out of time. You heard Charles Balavoine's cri du cœur about how we need to hear more of a voice from the French, from the Europeans. We were talking about Barack Obama's 2016 trip to Cuba. A year before that, François Hollande became the first ever French president to visit Cuba. Times have certainly changed in 11 years. What can France do? What can former colonial power Spain do? What can the European Union do?
Very complicated, because the U.S. is a global superpower. And, you know, I remember I was in the tarmac when François Hollande arrived in Havana. I was in Havana when Obama was there. The only moment in which I've seen Communist Party leaders nervous about the situation was back then, because they didn't know what to do. They're prepared for this kind of scenarios. It's harsh. It's going to be complicated for them, but they are prepared. This is what they're good at. Not diplomacy and not the approach that Obama had at the beginning. And well, regarding Europe, you know, France won concessions to reform railways and airports in Cuba. And during the Obama era, they rushed, rushed to Cuba to kind of like become the first partner in Europe. And they won a lot of concessions to make big businesses in Cuba. Trump arrived and they called Hollande and say, hey, no. Because, you know, we have changed the rules and you cannot do that. So there's no actually independence in this regard with Europe. And the National Assembly has a very interesting report on how the U.S. is profiting from this, preventing Europe to make money from businesses with Cuba, because it's the U.S., the only nation who can authorize themselves to sell meat, some medicine, and other things to Cuba.
I guess it's good if France doesn't make business with Gaesa and with the generals, taking into account that 50% of their investment are for business and hotel that come in their pocket, and just 1% is going to social development. So I don't see really why you would like France doing business with a
one final sentence, because we're out of time. Charlotte Balavoine.
Yeah, actually, I would like to know where are your sources from. And
Miami Herald did a very
comprehensive and I would like to have the same. I would like to have the same position on other countries as Saudi Arabia. What I want to say is that yes, we have some tools and we have legal tools against the United States, because as you said, the blockade is not only a twist to the Cuban sovereignty; it's as well a twist to our own sovereignty.
Right, so this call for international law to be better.
We have as well national and European law.
We're going to have to.
Assertive measures that we could apply.
And we're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. Charlotte Balavoine, we're out of time. I want to thank you, Axel Guilden. I want to thank as well Luis Miguel Cabrera, Lillian Guerra, for being with us from Gainesville, Florida. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.